until the last of the year when the National Assembly is elected. So, you know, none of these things go forward in neat packages. And it's been tough. It's been rough. We've had 33 attacks on American forces in the last 24 hours. That's what we should be focusing on. And the U.S. Congress should be focusing on getting this defense bill out that the House passed the other day. But the Senate, mired in this prison mess, hasn't gotten their bill out. We need to get that out, get it to the president, get the troops the tools that they need to get the job done, and let's hand this thing over.
When you say winning the war, how do you define winning the war?
I think we put together, we're not going to turn Iraq into Republicans and Democrats. And Lord knows, listening to Mr. Shalabi, there's going to be more stories of intrigue than you can shake a stick at. But what we have a chance to do is to have a nation that has a modicum of freedom for its people, basic freedoms for its people, and is benign with respect to its relationship with the United States. It is not a cohesive force. And we've, in that sense, to some degree, we've won the war in that we've dispelled, we've gotten rid of Saddam Hussein. We don't have an Iraq that's a cohesive force that can be danger to the United States. Now we have to see if we can hopefully make Iraq a cohesive force for freedom. But if we don't, if we have a...
Will you hack shut the hell up? What is this nonsense? In the sense that we got rid of Saddam, we won the war. Now I see how the Indians were the bad guys, how the Confederates were the states' rights patriots, and how the Klan was trying to protect white womanhood, and the Democrat and Republican Party are opposing parties. You fools rewrite history right before our eyes. And then you say, we have a chance in Iraq to have a nation that has basic freedoms. In other words, basically tell the Iraqi people their government and who is their government and what it's going to consist of. Basically tell the Iraqi people who owns and runs the oil supply under their feet. And basically tell the Iraqi people in what form is their oil traded in, i.e. U.S. greenbacks, dead, raggedy U.S. presidents. Iraqi people, keep shooting. I think you know what time it is. Slave time. Check this. You're listening to 104.1, 101.1 Santa Cruz, 106.7 Illinois, LUVER.com, the world, slave revolt time. Tonight, you know, these fools on this plantation are making it a little bit too easy. We're going to have to go back and revisit a little bit the shamelessness on why people are crying about NBA players not wanting to go, with some new facts hard on the ground. And then we're going to shoot our way into a certain form of Negro intellectualism, you know, Cornel West and them, Beyond the Shadow style. So we got all that and a hell of a lot more on 104.1 Slave Revolt.
They destroyed the world.
The entire Los Angeles area. Already hospital facilities have begun to crack under the strain. And civil defense authorities state that the situation is much the same across the entire country. Martial law is now nationwide.
Major cities in all parts of the country, New York, Los Angeles, report plague victims falling dead in the streets, in their homes, at their work. The first symptom appears to be severe choking, followed by immediate unconsciousness. Death occurs within minutes.
Whether a state of war between China and Russia still exists is not important any longer. Our fellow countrymen are dying. The very foundations of civilization are beginning to crumble under the dread assault of that horror long feared, germ warfare.
Carlo Rad Channel, this is a Class 1 emergency. All civilian traffic is barred from streets and highways. Stay in your homes. Stay in your homes. Those found without specific military orders are subject to summary execution. Stay in your homes. Repeat, Conrad Channel. This is a Class 1 emergency. All civilian traffic is barred from streets and highways.
Now the question is survival. Is this the end of technological man? Is this the conclusion of all our yesterdays? The boasts of our fabled science, the superhuman conquests of space and time, the age of the wheel. We were warned of judgment. Well, here it is. Here. Now. In the form of billions of microscopic bacilli. This is the end.
You know what time it is. Shameless style time. You know, last week, I played this segment on Ruins of Empire that dealt with a number of NBA players who were starting to worry about going over to Greece to play in the Summer Olympic Games just coming up around the corner. And, of course, in typical fashion, the show expressed some of their concerns, but at the same time had other people and coaches on saying it's not a good excuse and da 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 da, in a normal rhetoric. Well, lo and behold, the reason why it's on Shameless File now is that no sooner than the tapes get cool from the show that we did last week, here comes all this other information that would more than raise one's alarm bells about what the hell is going on over in Greece. But first, I'm going to play a little segment so you can get a feel for what went on last week. This is from last week's show. And then we'll go into the shamelessness that has really been perking in Greece, the Olympics, and other forms of nonsense. Hold this. Check this out.
This is all new to Jermaine. He's never been a part of one of these teams, one of these Olympic teams. And I think once he's had the opportunity to do that, he would understand that we do a lot of things to make sure that he's going to be secure.
The players and their families will stay on a cruise ship off the Greek coast while being protected by Greek and American authorities during the games. Those arrangements seemed unsettling to Ray Allen, who told the Associated Press, quote, "The only thing I can think of is the battleship that got blown up. It came up on the side of the USS Cole in a little boat."
We're going to have unbelievable security there, and it's going to be as safe as it can be. But I think as a parent, having a family and a wife and kids, is that I'm never going to put them in a situation that I don't have to.
I was already thinking about it before this happened, before this bombing. So, it's a big event worldwide, so it draws a lot of attention. So you kind of think that it's a good place for them.
Bad things can happen here too, so that's a bad excuse.
When it comes to excuses for not playing for Team USA, Larry Brown has heard them all. Kidd has a sore knee. Kenyon Martin needs to stay stateside to deal with his impending free agency. And Shaquille O'Neal says he's waiting to see how far the Lakers advance in the playoffs.
You can't get mad at them if they don't, though, you know? Because if you're in the playoff, your ultimate goal is to win an NBA championship. I don't care. Don't nothing replace an NBA championship. Not even a gold medal.
But they're not all playing for the championship. Vince Carter and Ray Allen say that wedding plans will keep them from making the trip. Once, say maybe 12 years ago, it would have been unthinkable for a player to choose nuptials over the quest for Olympic gold. But today's NBA players seem to have different priorities than their original Dream Team counterparts. And representing the red, white, and blue may not be at the top of the list.
Usually, the first time you ask a guy his first time, so usually he does it without hesitation. You know, second and third time, injuries start cropping up, other appointments start cropping up. You see a lot of things start coming up.
It bothers me. It bothers me a lot of guys, you know, that don't take it as a responsibility to represent our league. You know, I see all these foreign kids that they all want to do it. It's almost more important to them to represent their country than to play in the NBA.
We couldn't make it. I'm from Turkey, you know. That's my dream, too. I want to play one day in Olympic.
Mehmet Okur has his own wedding plans this summer. But he says if Turkey had qualified for the Games, matrimony would have had to wait.
I'm getting married too this summer. And let's say we play Olympic this summer. I'm not thinking about my marriage. I'm going to first my country. And I feel first national team, then my wedding.
I played for 15 years for my country, so... I'm proud of it. You know, it's different feeling. You don't play for your contract. You don't play for your money. You play for people.
For European guys, it's going to be much more difficult to say, oh, I don't want to play for Italy or Spain or France, because over there it's a big deal, national team. So it's going to be hard.
Yet Parker does acknowledge that the specter of terrorism is a frightening issue for the players, even for those who are not Americans.
Have to be careful. I'm happy that we're not qualified. I'm not going to be there.
Timberwolves coach Flip Saunders says the recent death of former NFL player Pat Tillman has had a chilling effect on all athletes, bringing home the security issue for them like never before.
Do you buy that guys realize that, you know, this is real, you could die there?
I guess so. But I also think you ought to think about what he sacrificed, you know, to go over there. You know, I don't know, they call it harm's way. He went in harm's way. We're just going to represent our country in the Olympics.
Nah, he was in war, man. He was in war. You understand that? Somebody was shooting at him. He was shooting back. Hey, man, that's a little different than going over there to play basketball.
You know, as I said last week, so I won't go too much into it, because we did this segment last week, was... you know, part of the reason why maybe some of these foreign players don't have as much concern is maybe it's because their country's not running around the planet pillaging everyone and creating such an uproar. But, you know, if Tillman and those clowns want to be, you know, some little lamb for the slaughter, that's fine. Get in the casket. Now, I said last week, don't believe them when you're talking about they're going to have unbelievable security and all of that type of rhetoric. Now, all of a sudden, a real sports investigation, which went into Greece and how these facilities have been going and getting built, it's turned out that Greece has been dragging its feet on its preparation for the Olympic Games since it was awarded the contract since 1997. And when you're dragging your feet and have as many loopholes as it's obvious that they do now, because many of the facilities aren't even finished, all types of things can arise. Check this out.
Is it fair to say, Mayor, that after you won the Olympic Games back in 1997, not a lot got done in the first few years?
That's true. Not a lot got done in the first years.
You've made the analogy to this whole business of getting the Olympics ready to a Greek folk dance.
To the Syrtaki dance. Yeah, I tried to say that the Syrtaki dance is a dance which starts slowly, and then when it speeds up, at the end, you can't even follow how quickly it goes. And that's exactly what's happening here.
In that case, they better dance as fast as they can because there's a lot to do. The marathon route, which retraces the original path from the town of Marathon into Athens, is a mess. Work stopped for a while after the original contractor went bankrupt. The new rail system from the airport to help visitors avoid Athens' notorious traffic isn't done. But the good news is there's a new tram that will take spectators from venue to venue. The bad news is it's not done either. As for the swimming venue, the good news is it is done. The bad news is there's no roof. The plans were scrapped in March because the project was way behind schedule. And then there's the crown jewel, the main Olympic stadium, where they'll hold the opening and closing ceremonies. The good news is it's supposed to look great when it's finished. There's just one slight problem. With about 100 days to go, it's not nearly done. The whole project is months behind schedule, to which the Greeks say, not to worry. By opening night, everything will be up and running. Maybe. Maybe because this is what the Greeks don't want you to see. When Real Sports got these shots from a rooftop next to the stadium at the end of April, it wasn't just landscaping and roads that needed help. The stadium seats weren't in, the track wasn't down, and the centerpiece, the architectural gem, the roof, wasn't completed either.
Having shared, if you want, the agony.
Stratis Strategis is a big-time Athens lawyer, the ultimate insider, who was in charge of the Athens organizing committee for the first year and a half before, he says, he quit in frustration, claiming, among other things, it was impossible to get anything done.
Is this a bureaucracy matter?
It is. It is very much.
Well, you Greeks invented bureaucracy.
Yes. Actually, we did. We did. We invented almost everything except organization. But you make me say things.
If I were to tell you that there are sources who are saying this is worse than anybody is letting on, there are technical problems in some of the venues, and they need to be fixed, and they need to be fixed fast, and they're not right now. Would you say that's probably true or not true?
That's probably true. That's probably true. But I think they will be fixed. If I had to have a major concern, it would be that in some venues, they might be perhaps not blackouts, but brownouts.
Do you mean literally, like the electricity may not work? Possible.
Awesome.
Now, what the hell is going on? He's talking about brownouts and all of these facilities that are not ready. Look, if you're anyone who's even gone by a construction site, you don't even have to have worked on it. You know that construction sites are very open facilities. And because you have to have them open to be able to bring in material and this and that. If you don't have stuff in place well in advance, you know, there's supposed to be some kind of security check place well in advance, then have teams go through to make sure everything is secure and there's no bombs or anything set in place inside the structure. You have no idea the type of sitting time bomb that you may be on. These guys, roofs that are not on, the train facilities aren't in place. The marathon route is a mess. That basically means that they also don't even have teams set up and prepared and trained to protect the runners and look as lookouts and stuff, because you would want all of that type of stuff coordinated. If you don't have all those teams have these particular areas and stuff where they've done dry runs and practice and coordination where a lot of these performances are going to be done, of course the athletes are vulnerable. I mean, this is this obvious, but these clowns want to play games and pretend, last week I'm talking about, that, you know, these athletes have, you know, kind of undue concern, and you heard these American, you know, Navy SEAL guys and government official guys talking about how they're going to have all types of security and this and that, and then here, they don't even have the structures even set in place. So that means that the U.S. teams, I'm talking about their little G.I. Joe teams and all of that, that are supposedly going to be over there to help protect the players. That means that they haven't been able to do whatever protection type run-throughs they're going to do either, because the facilities aren't done. It's this obvious. See, so no wonder why, once again, that the players would have some concern. They're right not to, first of all, they had no business representing this raggedy country in the first place. But, you know, this is slavery vote, so that goes without saying. I'm just talking about how last week they were kind of going back and forth with the players and, you know, do they have undue concern and how some are backing up. And then all of a sudden, here we have all this information that they didn't even let on about the crisis that the whole building structures and other things are going on in Greece. That shows you once again the contempt they really have for the athletes, which is typical because, you know, you see the same type of contempt for the soldiers and on down the line.
I'm sorry. Going out there. Going out there.
Die for your country like a fool. Now, next, the host and others go into the real concern beyond having the building structure up and ready for the summer. So let's check out what they have to say, and we'll take it from there. Like this.
But if there's an understandable concern about whether all the construction will be finished and all the paint will be dry by the time the games begin, the real anxiety is about something else altogether. These are the first Summer Olympics, after all, since September 11th, 2001.
Would I be surprised if there was a terrorist incident successfully? No, I wouldn't.
Oliver Buck Revelle was the FBI's number two man in charge of counterterrorism for 11 of his 30 years at the Bureau. He was also involved with security planning for six Olympics.
What do you think of Athens as a site?
If it had been after 9/11, I truly do not believe that Athens would have been selected. Greece has been a difficult problem for us in the West on terrorism since at least 1975. They had the worst track record of any of the European countries in dealing with terrorism, both international and domestic.
Hey, listening to that, I mean, is there a worse place they could have picked than Athens?
Baghdad. That's the only place I can think of right now that would be more difficult to protect than Athens, Greece.
That's partly because of Greece's porous sea and land borders and its proximity to the Balkans, Turkey, and the Middle East, all of which makes Athens an especially serious target for terrorism.
I'm willing to accept that this is going to sound ridiculous, but this would be terrible PR for Al-Qaeda to do something like blow up part of the Olympics.
They don't care about PR. Their PR is that they are attacking the great Satan. They're attacking the United States and the Western world, and we're better to do it than in the cradle of democracy.
Which is why the Greeks have spent an unprecedented $1 billion on security and military exercises like these. They'll have 70,000 troops and police officers on the job. They're putting up 1,400 security cameras all over the city. And right after the bombings in Madrid, Greece got NATO to agree to patrol its borders. Still, the mayor says, neither she nor anyone else can guarantee that nothing will go wrong once the games begin.
I cannot say to anybody that you will be 100 or 1,000% sure in Athens. But it is exactly the same chances than you have in any corner of the world.
More than a few of the venues, as we sit here and speak, aren't finished yet.
That's correct.
Does that pose a special security challenge?
If they're completed 2 weeks before, they won't have time to do it on a regular schedule. It's going to have to be a crash schedule. Anytime you do anything very abruptly and in a hurry, you're liable to make mistakes.
We're just going to walk right on through.
And while we were in Athens, we decided to see how tough it would be to simply walk into one of the venues without any credentials, just with a hidden camera.
Yeah, we're from Afghanistan. We're going to just walk in.
Okay.
Taliban. So much for security. If you were running, would you want somebody just walking through the front door of an unfinished arena?
No, I'd seal off all the key sites so that only those that were cleared could be allowed in, and they couldn't take photographs, they couldn't make drawings, and so forth. Al-Qaeda has shown that it is very adept at intense planning.
Nobody asked us who we are. Nobody wants to see an identification. We're in one of the main venues of the Summer Olympics.
As I was saying before, NBA brothers, don't go. Look, here's one of these little FBI guys. Now, he's, you know, not only an iron-fist imperialist for the empire, but he's a propagandist. And he's saying he wouldn't be surprised if there was a hit in the Olympics. And guess who some of their number one targets are going to be? Fools in the red, white, and blue. And then he talked about how Athens has the worst track record and how they're still building facilities up right to the deadline. And how, and you heard the one guy walk in, you know, and tell the workers that he was from Afghanistan and he was a Taliban. They just let him go right in. He could have planted a bomb or took whatever pictures right then and there. This whole thing's a scam. But they didn't let you know this. You know, on that piece I played last week, when they were going back and forth with the NBA players, they didn't let on in any way that things were in this much of a crisis. You know, they just played on some little false patriotic duty that the NBA players were supposed to have. In other words, go get killed for nothing. Now, on this last part that we have concerning this little... NBA and the Summer Olympic Games stuff. The real sports people go into how the Greeks have their own internal problems, let alone external problems to be concerned about. This is what I mean, Big Viz.
But it's not just Al-Qaeda that poses a potential terrorist threat. There's also the homegrown variety, domestic Greek terrorism. There's an anti-capitalist leftist group called 17 November that has killed at least 23 people in Greece over the past 30 years, among them American and British diplomats and Greek politicians, including the mayor's own husband.
My first husband was assassinated by terrorists, so I have a very personal experience and a very personal dedication for the anti-terrorist war. But let's look at it the way it is realistically. We are living in an uncertain world.
More uncertain because 17 November isn't the only domestic terror group. In February, another activist group set off bombs as Olympic officials met in Athens. And just this month, a group of local anarchists set off three bombs outside an Athens police station, to which the Greeks at the time said, not to worry.
It has nothing to do with the security of the Olympic Games.
But 1 week later, a group called Revolutionary Struggle claimed the bombs were linked to the upcoming games, and that some visitors, heads of state and wealthy Western tourists in particular, would be, quote, undesirable at the Olympics.
One of the troubling things about the recent bombings has been the attempt by the Greek authorities to downplay their significance. You don't know which groups will take the opportunity to have the worldwide stage, and certainly they have not all been neutralized in the build-up to the Olympics.
But for now, Athens is simply trying to finish what might be the most important race of the whole summer. Yes, it is a city that has always carried a flame for the Olympics. And with the games just 3 months off, everyone here is saying, just watch. Everything will be ready in time for the opening of the games on August 13th. Friday, the 13th.
Friday the 13th is right. Like I said last week, keep your black asses here. Look, man. Don't be a sucker to U.S. propaganda. They don't deserve your talents going over there in the first place. They obviously don't respect your own well-being. That piece last week, they just propagandized it as, you know, concerns and maybe it's some of the players' first time in Olympic Games, so they don't know how safe it is. And then, here we have all this information that things are in chaos. They didn't let on at all. That little corporate propaganda show that I got this from last week, they didn't let on at all about all of these things that have been going on and groups that have been bombing up the place and actually saying and making threats towards
wealthy Americans.
Yeah.
And who are you?
And U.S. people, you know, officials and things of that particular nature. Don't waste your time. Skip that. This raggedy flag is nothing worth representing in the first place.
Listen. You know what? They trying to hit y'all with that propaganda stick. Remember this. patriotism is the last refuge of scoundrels.
And you remember when Jordan and them went to the Olympics with the Dream Team? And, you know, they're always telling athletes, especially black athletes, to take care of their funds better and all of this type of rhetoric, you know. So when those in the past, like Joe Louis, had gone broke, they chastised them as being, you know, imbeciles and stuff like that. Well, you know, when Jordan went to the Olympic game, he saw that his image was on all of these T-shirts, and he has a patent on his image. You know, he's being a little businessman, you know, something they always propagandize to the black athletes. So he played his little role. So he said, hey, wait a minute, you can't use my image on those T-shirts without paying me. And it turned out it was part of the U.S. Olympic Committee. And they, so he threw out his unpatriotic card at him, you know. So they just talk out of you know where. Then, just like in this case, telling you it's all going to be okay, and you're going to be in about 2,000 little pieces floating in the Atlantic. Nah, keep your behinds here. We got things to do here. Like overthrow Sam. Hold on a sec.
Everywhere. I was right. Everything I knew was wrong.
All right, next up, we're going to go into a quick Beyond the Shadow segment. And what we're going to deal with is a discussion between Cornel West and Toni Morrison, the Nobel laureate winner. They had a discussion talking about a variety of things. And basically, while I don't disagree with all of the stuff that they're basically saying, overall, there needs to be a focus and kind of a getting beyond some of the smoke and shadow that is often thrown around. Because at the end of the day, it's class warfare or Holocaust. And we're going to have to get our class to start whipping some ass, or it's all she wrote. So, first off, they start off by asking Morrison, Cornel does, about how she feels about our historical moment at this present time. So, let's see what she says about that. And then we'll take it from there. Check this out.
We want to begin just by raising the general query of how you would characterize our historical moment.
I feel two things, terrified and melancholy at the same time. And think in both domestic and foreign affairs, it's frightening. The alterations, the agenda. But at the same time, there have been other frightening moments. But this melancholy that I feel now is about a country like this with the best shot in the world. The best shot in the world. At this moment, at this time, with a certain kind of plenitude and intelligence and ambition and generosity and some history from which to learn, could indeed throw it away, in a sense, and become the worst parts of its own self.
For me, I don't think we're going to talk about getting out of the mess that we're in unless we engage the younger generation.
No question.
And the younger generation, they on a different vibe than a lot of us. They're on a very different vibe.
But we need the language. We need the language. We have to talk.
We got to talk. And
there's
we
a whole generation
respect.
Of us who never said anything.
Exactly.
You know, to the younger
to
people.
To the young folk. And they're just out there. They're struggling. They got unbelievable creativity and imagination, but trying to channel their moral outrage. They're locked into this market with this dominant market way of life. But they also know that it's empty and hollow in the end. All it is chains and bling bling is just, what Nathaniel West called the paraphernalia of suffering.
Oof.
Yeah, that's a powerful phrase. Powerful phrase.
It
really is. But he was getting at something that I think we've got to engage the younger generation with, because in some sense they're imitating us, our materialism, careerism, and so on. But in another sense, they also have grown up in a different kind of world. I mean, their world is so market saturated that it's hard for them to gain access to non-market values and activities that they can ascribe weight to, because everybody's gimme, gimme, gimme.
All right, now, like I said before, not that a lot of this stuff is what I would consider a hard disagreement or anything like that. But it's kind of interesting to hear. First, I'll start off with Morrison. As she talks about how this country has the best shot in the world and its generosity and, you know, it could be throwing it away and all of that type of stuff. You know, in reality, even if this country was not as vulturistic, it's still rooted in a market system. And that market-based system still has a pyramid hierarchical structure that wants to keep everything in a particular order, including energy. So you have a situation where there's a dead zone in the Mississippi. It's 7,500 feet long. It's destroying the Mississippi River. Now, part of this is because of the petroleum-based system that we're in, a dead energy system. Fertilizers made based out of petroleum. You have all these runoffs from all these different states, and one of the main arteries that they go into is, of course, the Mississippi River, along with all the other contaminants. And it has created an oxygenated dead zone where the Mississippi River is going through an ecological collapse. Now, these corporations have no incentive, the oil corporations, so on and so forth, to go into a living energy system like solar or wind power, because they want to control the markets that they already have in. If they were to allow, even within a market system, another form to come, that would be a competitor. They don't want competitors, so they keep the world's economies and the world's energy systems locked into a dead energy system, which that is what fossil fuel is. That's why they call it dead energy. Well, that's why I call it, at least. So you have a situation where the world is locked into a dead energy system. It's destroying and corroding the world, the atmosphere. It's destroying oceans, along with other things that are going on, overfishing and stuff like that. And the market system that we're in, just by itself, you know, is hemorrhaging the planet. It's bringing the planet to its knees. So to talk about how the country could be more generous in its dealings with you know, other people throughout the world, or be more generous into how it treats its own population, when you have a market structure that's in contradiction to that, is being in a form of an illusion. It's just not going to happen. And it's to have a feeling, it's to get into some of this individual stuff, you know, of how you meet individuals. And certain individuals are very generous and stuff like that, and very sympathetic. But it doesn't get into how states and empires actually play themselves out. Now, when West goes into, you know, the bling bling and hip hop and stuff, like, I touched on this before, because, you know, it's kind of almost hysterical to see someone from like the King generation that was really kind of an element that was down with capitalism. They didn't have a strong critique on capitalism. Many of them went right into the Democratic Party, and, you know, you've seen what happened with the NAACP and all of that. What's his face? Cornel West himself had voted for Clinton, you know, and so on and so forth. So here you've seen someone who basically has approached people like a Clinton and the business community, which, you know, Clinton and them represent. They're administrators for the ruling class. Now, the reason why I mention this is, along with that, there's always been this talk amongst those types that Hollywood does not see black and white when it comes to making profit. It only sees green, you know, and all of it. That was the propaganda that has always been thrown out by those types. The reality is how hip-hop got so distorted and warped. When hip-hop first emerged, its market base was the same people who created the music. Blacks and Puerto Ricans created hip-hop, and they were the main record buyers of the form of music. So they had the dominant influence. In other words, the hip-hop artists catered to that market, and the record producers and executives within that market sphere, you know, basically, you know, based how good a record sold based off of that particular audience. And at that time, you had, you know, a lot of social conscious hip hop, political hip hop. You had some, you know, kind of street hip hop. You had kind of a black feminist hip hop, you know, ladies first and all of that type of stuff. Spiritual hip hop, you know, invisible man believers and things of that particular nature. And no one side dominated over another. But as hip hop became more national in scope, and its market scope expanded, blacks and Puerto Ricans no longer became the dominant record buyers of that music. Whites did. It became a white market force that was dominant. And then at that point, you started to see a shift in how the music was created, because it was now catering to another audience primarily. And at that point, you started to see historical stereotypes and beliefs start to reemerge that have always been simmering, sometimes overtly, sometimes more covertly, in the psyche of a large segment of the population. Before the Civil War, whites created an image, a construct of blacks that was supposed to be representative of the black slaves. They often performed them themselves in minstrels. It was the Happy Sambo. They performed it themselves, put blackface on, and they often talked in this, you know, outrageous that, well, the other day I found 3 chickens, and 2 days later I found me 3 more chickens. That makes 4 chickens, and I figured if I find 4 more, I'd be a rich man. And the Happy Sambo would wear all of his material possession on him at the same time. Top hat, shiny shoes, you know, loud colored socks, the whole bit. And whites would laugh historically at this image because nothing was more appealing to the white psyche and consoling to the white psyche than a black person who not only did not know he was not free, but was happy in his situation. These bling bling super diamond wearing Negroes are nothing but a modern day adaptation to the Happy Sambo. Now, after the Civil War, when 200,000 black people picked up the gun to crush the South, which is the most important advancement black people have made since we've been in the country, the Happy Sambo image was not the only image that whites could use to contain socially, construct and contain black folks. And thus you saw the emergence of the legendary Zip Coon. The legendary Zip Coon was the most violent prone image ever created by whites. This was the ultimate menace to society, exemplified in D.W. Griffith's movie Birth of a Nation, where you see a Zip Coon, once again played by a white person in blackface. And what was his first mission? To rape the vulnerable, virginal white woman. This violent prone Zip Coon was a menace that had to be stopped by all means. And the justification of violence against the Zip Coon, even by the Klan, got its nod of the approval. Because after all, the razor-toting, neck-slashing rapist, Zip Coon had no decent morals whatsoever. These gangster, prankster, thugs, you know, ultimate killers and all of that type of stuff are nothing more than a modern day adaptation to the Zip Coon image. Once again, created by white folks. Now, what has happened to hip hop? The market system has happened to hip hop, is what I'm saying. And these Negroes out there are performing a skit within our market base, this market base, barbaric society.
Well, I mean, you done ran it all down. Now you ain't leading nothing to nobody else, homie. Because no, look around, Public Enemy, where they at? Let's look at the sales for an album like Paris's Latest, Sonic Jihad, probably 100,000 or less.
And at one time, within a market system, the sales of those were considered quite good, but that was because the market was much smaller. It was primarily black and like Puerto Ricans buying the music. But once the market expanded and, you know, was quote unquote more integrated into white consumption habits, then the perspective of what it is to have a successful album changed dramatically. And so then you had forces that can come out and say, this is no longer a success because so-and-so is selling this much joints, basically playing this nonsense, but it's being bought up. So this is what you want to get with if you want to be quote-unquote a success and get a record deal with us.
Even the great KRS-One, Chris Parker, has been somewhat peripheralized in the current market. Mm-hmm. And he is the baddest, probably the baddest living DJ today.
Now, next, Morrison goes into what happened after September 11th. So let's deal with that as she explains her views. Dig this.
No, it's pernicious. I mean, when you think of after September 11th, when anybody would have done practically anything to help, I was waiting for some guy, the mayor guy, the governor guy. I mean, they did, you know, things, but there was something like that I wanted to hear. Like, go home, see if everybody's all right, build this, check your neighbors, get some food, you know, sort of a action. But what they said was go to the store. Oh, yeah, they said go to the malls, go to the theaters, get back on those airplanes, buy. Now, I understand what they were saying. They were saying the market, you know, the point of the attack was to destroy things. One of which would be the economy, the capitalist system, etc. So we want the markets to go on. That was one thing. That could have been said along with some other things.
Absolutely.
But to tell people to go to the store, go to the mall, get back on those planes. So people just began to send money because they wanted to help. Mm. But that was the only exchange there was.
But see, that just...
That meant that we were not to be called on as citizens, only as consumers.
Ooh, it's a deep point. That's a deep point. That's a deep point.
It's true.
I mean, it shows just how idolatrous the market is in the culture. It's a fetish, you know. We ascribe these magical powers to it so that your public interest and your public life is just drained. I mean, a good example of this is that you and I travel all around the country. And you meet so many Americans, all colors, all classes, sexual orientation, gender. And there's tremendous creativity, imagination, intelligence among large numbers of American citizens all over. But then you raise your question, how do we end up with the mediocre, mendacious leaders that we have? It's supposed to be a democratic process. But there's a hemorrhaging that's taking place when it comes to public life.
Money.
Because public life is just an appendage and an extension of the market.
Right.
So our political elites beholden to the corporate elites. Mm-hmm. The candidates just packaged in elections. Mm-hmm. The pollsters running what the conscience of the... politician is supposed to be. And then when you make this point about after 9/11, they say, consume, consume, consume.
That will save us. And no request for, you know, something that would require us to stand up as citizens.
Absolutely.
Now, of course, New Yorkers just did it anyway. But that was interesting to me at that moment.
Okay.
Well, this point about citizenship is probably the most important thing that they've said thus far. You see, because Americans, due to the cultural shifts, the intellectual trends, these things take place gradually, not all at once, but they just chip away at it, bit by bit, through the idiot box, through their little sitcoms, you know, through all the, you know, interchange that goes on in this society of so-called ideas, to the point which people don't even know what democracy is anymore. Now, I can remember in my lifetime, there used to be little neighborhood committees to keep the rent down, and, you know, little tenant unions and things like that. Everywhere, people were involved. In fact, there's an excellent book out right now that discusses this whole thing about social atomization. It's called Bowling Alone. Check that out. Because it's gone so far now to where people just stay home on the computer. People just, you know, they got the games for the kids, keep them in the house. But at no time, you got 80 channels on your television, but nothing's really on. And at no time, they want you to live in a world where you don't interact with anybody until you go to make the man some money. And then, of course, shop.
Another aspect of what they really want you to do also, beyond consume, is just be afraid of one another. In reality, they were talking constantly about your neighbor may be a terrorist. Take a second look at him. Be worried about him. Call us if you have any concerns, and we'll give you some money to do it. So, you know, that whole aspect, because they have created an atmosphere starting with the whole Zip Coon image that you see personified today. As I've been saying for a while, the Arabs and, you know, many other people, Indians and so on and so forth, they've been Negrofied. And part because the Negro question has never really been dealt with. So all of that so-called model minority image and stuff that they used to toss around, you never hear those terms anymore. They don't call anyone model minority anymore. They don't call Chinese, Japanese, East End, no one's model. After 9/11, you're all Negroes. So, and that model of fear is rooted in the history of creating the Black menace image, the Zip Coon. So Arabs have been Zip Coon and on down the line. This has always been a product. Even when during World War II, it was very easy for the rulers to flip the switch on Japanese, in turn them, demonize them. In other words, Zip Coon them. When these issues aren't addressed, and this happened in the 40s, and people's memories are so short that they go right back to this false image of America, the democracy, without honestly assessing these types of issues, then it's easy to see how that slide down. Now, as far as New Yorkers standing up and helping each other out and all of that, you know, I can't even say that really happened in a way that it should have, because yes, workers should, you know, you had workers coming to the sites and all of that. But right now you have thousands of workers in the New York area and other people who are sick from the Ground Zero site, where they were told by the government and the EPA that it was okay to work and you didn't even need a respirator there. It was all a lie. There was all types of harmful material in the air. They lied to them. Where's that type of solidarity on that level? See, people have been programmed to generate sympathy and organize amongst themselves for their basic rights almost when the masters tell them to. But when it's an obvious principle thing, here these thugs had people going back to these sites. They gave out misinformation and had people going back to their homes and schools without those facilities being properly cleaned up, because they wanted people back into the little consumer mode and Wall Street back on duty. All these people have been and are going to get sick from those effects. That's when you see how conscious people are. And unfortunately, it's just not there. Now next, Cornel West talks about confronting pathologies like white supremacy. And they get into Condoleezza Rice a little bit. So let's see how they deal with this. Check this out.
But in that sense, it's very much like white supremacy. It's a pathology that's shot through the civilization that we have to confront with our bitterness. And I love what you're talking about in terms of love being something earned. But it's still something that's worth taking a risk for.
Oh, yes.
You see what I mean?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And I think that, I think in the history of black people, we've been so hated that love takes on subversive status.
Oh, it's real renegade.
Look at that, see?
Totally renegade.
So John Coltrane talking about love supreme, this is not just a gesture. You know what I mean? When Martin Luther King talked about love, it's not just a gesture. This thing is rooted in a long tradition of struggle against institutionalized hatred that then becomes contagious, because other people want to be more human than they are too, and to be in on it. But how we end up regenerating public life, I mean, I think that's one of our major challenges at this moment.
It's about time for the questions.
Okay, thanks so much.
Give it to the guy, right?
Nothing.
You don't have to answer all these questions. Have they been edited, these questions?
If Condoleezza Rice were with us this evening, what would you say to her? did you want to answer that question?
I would strongly suggest that Condoleezza Rice get another job. I know how seductive power is.
Absolutely.
She is an educated woman. She's a gifted woman. She's a talented woman. And she has a lot of attributes. She just... why trash them in an area? And I know that she has benefited time and time again from that part of the political spectrum, and particularly that family. But loyalty is not...
is at the top for black people. And then to use such brilliance in the form of service to mendacious
a rationale
elites.
For, yeah. You know...
I got to pray on that. I really do. I got to pray on that.
Yeah, well, you gonna pray alone, Negro. I tell you, that's a real strong contradiction in this man, because he is a very intelligent and talented person. And I just never could get past his little mysticism, you know? I thought Tony got it right, though. If there is such a thing as a sin, it is utilizing your talents in the service of white supremacy and imperialism.
Well, this is a long tradition, you know, house slaves, house-type Negroes, field Negroes, you know, metaphorically and all of that type of stuff. And on the real, those who played the role of foreman, often people look out for their own particular interests. You know, someone like Condoleezza Rice, all I would have to say to her is any last words. I mean, she's just my enemy. And telling her to get another job and all of that type of stuff, while it sounds cute and all of that type of stuff, and can't we, it's this kind of can't we all get along theme.
Just about.
And, you know, she's just down with her crew. That's how she's made her living. That's the type of vision of a world that she and Colin Powell and you know, Armstrong Williams and Stanley Crouch and Shelby Steele and, you know, a whole host of other those types of Negroes.
Did you know, mention Colin Cancer?
Wynton Marcellus, et cetera, et cetera. That's the type of world that they want and vision that they want. It's this kind of conservative to neoconservative model. And, you know, that's just their thing. It ain't no thing to me, you know. I just know what I'm down with and what I'm not down with. Wait, hold on.
Yeah, but you know what? This is what we here at Slave Revolt try to, not to be, insofar as we can, politicize the relationships and the social positions that these Negroes hold. So you understand, this is not just a personal vendetta between us and them. No. This woman, Condoleezza Rice, has been tested by the capitalists for years. What, remember, didn't Standard Oil name a ship after her?
It was Chevron. I mean, people have heard, you know, me do things, me meaning Tracy, do things on and takes on these particular characters and positions that they've had, you know, like Shelby Steele was defending at the time what was going on in Florida and basically trying to write it off. And just basically try to say it was just like a figment of black imagination that things had gone, you know, astray. You know, this whole, you know, black folks are conspiratorial type thing. You know, I think that part of the reason why West and those types think that they can relate to a Condoleezza Rice on a personal level is because they actually think that since black people sacrificed so much in the civil rights movement, and it was to get us, integrated into this whole society, as their vision saw, Now, of course, there was another segment that was saying we need to critique this society and decide what we need to do with a system that is going to perpetually breed this type of divisions and so on and so forth. The reason why I point this out is that South Africa is on a similar type of crossroads to where for many people and propagandists, they saw that black liberation was basically having black people elected to office, black people being able to vote, and then over time, black people would be integrated into the society, you know, and have a more fair, equitable share. Now, Mandela and many of them did not have a hard line on the capitalist market system. And not having a hard line on the capitalist market system, they didn't have a real hard line on apartheid itself overall. Because apartheid was similar to Jim Crow. It served as scaffolding for the capitalists to the point where the capitalists were able to build the house of inequality, where you had super exploitation and super profits for the capitalists being built off of the scaffolding, i.e. apartheid system, Jim Crowism. After the house of inequality is built, you can take apartheid down. You could take Jim Crow down, because the house of inequality would stand on itself. And that's the situation that black South Africans have found themselves in. Whites were 4% of the population during apartheid. They own 70% of the land. Whites are 4% of the population. They own 75 to 80% post-apartheid. They own the major industry. They are able to exacerbate all of these issues. And at the same time, the whole market system itself is not being brought into question by many of those leaders who still see many of these contradictions going on. And similar things have gone on within the market system and the market capitalists in this country. Post-Jim Crowism. So Condoleezza Rice is really behaving like many of the people in the ANC in South Africa, running and getting her diamonds. She's just an educated bling blinger. She's educated. She uses her education to get her bling. So in many ways, it's very similar to what you often hear many people complain about you know, the poor desperate types for doing.
Yeah, but I think actually she's a bit of an ideologue, Tracy. I think she really believed in that.
I pointed that out before. Yeah. But what I'm saying is that you know, there's no point. I mean, she knows what she's down with.
That's right. Ain't no doubt about that.
And she's going to be down with it till the end. She's made her alliances. So you know,
actually, Boondocks has been suggesting in his recent column that the thing she's down with is in between old boy George's legs.
She asked Magruder to do some stuff on her.
No, she didn't.
Yes, she did.
No.
I heard him in an interview. So he said, okay, he would. That's just a fact.
What? Did you see what he did?
Yeah. Look, she's not worrying about that. She don't care. She get a little laugh out of it. It ain't gonna change nothing. I mean, that's, you know, I wasn't surprised. Magruder had made it clear that he had disagreed with her, you know, because he had said some stuff at like some NAACP award winning.
Right, that she had spoke yet also.
And said, you know, how could she be getting an award, you know, and all of that type of stuff. And then he talked about how he met her one time and she just came up to him, told him she reads the script and, you know, and all of that type of stuff. And she wanted him to include her in on the script. And he said he would.
No, but with Tracy, can I tell you something? From my reading, I can't read her mind. And you may be right that she don't care. But that thing is so funny and vicious.
Well, wait a minute.
I don't know if she wanted that.
Well,
might have got more than she bargained for.
Well, I think that's more wishful thinking, because at the end of the day, I don't think it changes a thing. on the real. She still got her class that she is aligned with. And they're down with her regardless of what Magruder writes in some little cartoon script. I mean, the working class in general is not organized to do what would really put fear in their heart. So, you know, they can have a little laugh. This is like a little roasting, you know, at best. I said before, Magruder made some remarks that were negative about her before, while in her presence. She didn't even have a problem with it. And she told him she would like to be included. Now, she has seen how he writes about other people before and how he can get, you know, his thorns going and his swords going on people. So, knowing that he had said this type of stuff before about, you know, like the one-time owner of BET, you know, how he clowned, you know, that Negro and so on and so forth, and other people, I mean, please. But next, Wes goes into what he says was one of the bleakest episodes in the American experience. Let's see what he has to say. Check this out.
We come now to our president. What do we see? A bleak moment. Let's be honest. One of the bleakest moments in the history of the civilization. America is now, it's not only an empire, but in scope, in depth, in power, it exceeds the British and the Roman Empire. Nothing like it in the history of humankind. No countervailing force at all. The repressive and regimenting Soviet Empire went under 12 years ago. It was a countervailing force. It supported Mandela, and he was a terrorist for 27 years. We'd like to remind Americans of that. There's no countervailing force. And like both empires, arrogance, hubris, feels as if it can shape the world in its own image, dictate its terms in terms of what it wants to do.
As my dear brother Noam Chomsky reminds us, not only put forward a new doctrine of preemptive strike. That's a doctrine that says that if it looks as if someone's about to attack you, you attack them before they're able to. That's not what the new doctrine. This doctrine says if a nation has a set of elites who are contemplating possibly challenging the U.S. power, they are subject to attack. That's preventive war. That's a new norm in international relations. It's the law of the jungle. It sends signs and signals. Troops, 100 nations. Bases in 70 nations. A major carrier in every ocean. Internally, 1% of population owning 48% of net wealth, financial wealth, 5% own 70% of the wealth, and that's before the tax cut. And the result is what? As you can imagine, the most vulnerable, beginning with who? The children. It's already 22% of all of America's children live in poverty, richest nation in the history of the world. It's a disgrace. Disgrace. The children. It's 7% in Canada. It's 6% in Japan. It's 22% in America. 42% of red children. 39% of brown children. 37% of black children. They are 100% of the future. Poverty educates. Shapes the way they look at the world. Gives them a sense of who they are. The untrustworthiness of existence. And here, the greatest empire in the history of the world has this plutocratic, oligarchic, to some degree still pigmentocratic, hierarchy in its economy. And then the most vulnerable, the children. And who are connected to those children? Poor women. Workers of gold. Handicapped. Disproportionately black, brown, and red, yes, but numerically mainly. White brothers and sisters. Where's the pity? Where's the outrage? Where's the indignation? Or is it that the sleepwalking taking place has become so normative that we feel as if we can't make a difference? What is going on?
What's basically going on? I won't go too much into this. Is that this is an empire that basically is filling its oats. It's, most of its major competitors and ideological competitors have folded up their little tents, have rolled up the red carpet, so to speak, like China, and rolled out the McDonald's flag. Soviet Union said no mas. Cuba is pretty well contained. But, and as I've been saying before, you have a situation where, intelligentsia, those who are administrators for the ruling class, like the presidents and all of that type of stuff, that intelligentsia has basically dwindled down and is more focused in on how to get reelected. Because they don't feel they have to have those types of administrators who are more adept on foreign affairs. So this is in many ways a natural development of an empire that has so much incredible firepower. It has always had a willingness to use it. This whole preventive strike and all of that, that's not a new norm as West goes into. I mean, Chile, that's a prime example of what they did to another country on 9/11, September 11th, 1973, to overthrow a country from within. What they were attempting to do in Venezuela recently, a couple of years back, all of those Indian attacks on this plantation are nothing but preventative, quote unquote, strikes against indigenous people. This country has always operated in striking out against those who felt it may impede its interests, whether they were a physical threat or not. That's the way of the empire. It's been nothing new until we finally put it to rest. Hold on.
This large and didn't realize that there were some enemies present.
Yes, good evening, brothers and sisters. I'm Gerald Smith, and this is your Making It Plain News. Well, one has to wonder, when you're looking around at the hypocrisy and the madness that's around us. The demented and spiritually tormented Congressman Tom DeLay, House Majority Leader, begins his speeches with the words, and I quote, "Good evening, or morning, or afternoon," or as John Kerry would say, "Bonjour." unquote. Now, this greeting is meant to indicate that Senator Kerry speaks French and is therefore un-American. You understand? This is how ignorant they don't got. Oh, it's sad. He's unpatriotic and untrustworthy because he speaks French. Remember the Freedom Fries? Oh, boy. And it is considered hilarious by many 6 years old. The French for good evening, by the way, is bonsoir. But that doesn't stop the militant Christian humbug draft dodger delay from trying to get a laugh by employing a pathetically unfunny catchphrase. But what now, one wonders, because his hero, the man appointed to the White House by God, as DeLay and Boykin like to tell us is the case, has been recorded as using the F word. That's right, and you know I'm talking about Boy George right now. And I got to quote this. So I'm keenly aware of what's in the papers. Some kind of the issue de jure, unquote. Bush told this to Bill Salmon, the Washington Times correspondent, whose paper is serializing his book about Bush. My goodness, the issue de jure. The man used a French phrase. Well, what's next? Might DeLay be forced to listen to more unpatriotic utterances by this French fried, loving, cheese-eating, frog-goblin devotee of je ne sais quoi? I tell you, it's really ironic, but sad. You know, oh, yeah. I have to issue out a warning to our brothers and sisters because these MRTDs are here, and they're coming, and they're coming hard. With the passing of the USA Patriot Act and the Enhanced Border Security and Visa Entry Reform Act of 2002, came the provision for a biometric technology standard for, get this now, Machine Readable Travel Documents, MTRDs. Machine Readable Travel Documents that all foreigners must have when entering the United States after October 2004. The very topic of MRTDs, which include Machine Readable Passports, MRPs, Machine Readable Visas, MRVs, and other more specialized travel documents was at the basis of the International Civil Aviation Organization this last period they had in April in Cairo. The International Civil Aviation Organization, which creates standards for 180 client states, including the United States, the European Union, Great Britain, has reached an agreement for implementing a biometric standard for MRTDs, which includes facial recognition and allows for the secondary use of either hand or eye scans, should the client state decide. Implementation of MRTDs will pave the way for the creation of national databases to store the biometric information. That data will be easily tied to the citizen, and this is where much concern arises. I don't think I have to get into too much detail to explain to you why we have to oppose this. Do we want Sam having that kind of power and control? Well, you know what? Looks like they lie so much it's hard to tell. So I guess I have to say, when the American military is talking, they're lying. Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez has now been linked to Abu Ghraib abuse. Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez, who is head of the coalition forces in Iraq, issued an order last October giving military intelligence control over almost every aspect of prison conditions at Abu Ghraib. With the explicit aim of manipulating the detainees' quote, emotions and weaknesses. This was reported just a few days ago. And in a leaked memo, naturally. Well, you know, you have to look and wonder when you start to see what kind of trouble these people are really in. Because the setbacks that have occurred in Iraq, and I'm talking about the military setbacks, have now changed the mood in Washington. Lawmakers in both parties, as well as some military leaders, fear the occupation is heading toward failure. Bush stands firm, but U.S. goals may be scaled back. President Bush is hearing increasingly bleak warnings that the U.S. occupation of Iraq is headed for failure. From the Republicans and the Democratic Party members of Congress, current and former officials, and even some military officers still on active duty. But so far, at least, the White House says it hasn't heard anything that makes it want to change course. Surprise, surprise. That's right. Weeks of military and political setbacks have produced a striking change of mood in the Capitol about the prospects for success in Iraq, where U.S. and allied forces are struggling to establish security to allow the so-called new Iraqi caretaker government to begin work on June 30th. Well, first of all, does that mean the troops are going to withdraw? Hell no! So what will have changed? One has to wonder. Well, I tell you what's going to change. We're going to have to put a beating on them, y'all. It's going to start here because their arrogance is just over the top. Get this. America's contempt for the whole world has been bushwhacked in the Caribbean. On February the 29th, as you know, if you listen to Slave Revolt, the legally elected government of Haiti was driven from power by armed force. That is, the Marines. Not them little pompadours and chumps that they flew in. The Marines. Let's get it right. The United States Marines took that man out of that country and pulled that coup off. Its president, after being taken against his will to the Central African Republic, was given refuge in Jamaica. The Bush administration's response has been to demand that the democratic countries of the Caribbean, one, drop their call for an investigation into the ouster of President Jean-Bertrand Aristide. Oh, yeah? Two, it gets worse. Push the Aristide family out of Jamaica and the region. And three, abandon their policy of admitting only democratically elected governments into the councils of CARICOM, a multilateral organization established by the English-speaking Caribbean countries 31 years ago to promote regional cooperation. In addition, National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice has warned CARICOM leaders that if one U.S. soldier is killed in Haiti, Caribbean governments will be held responsible because the Aristide family was granted sanctuary in the region. In short, the Bush administration is strong-arming the Caribbean to confer on Haiti's new government, so-called. Now, this is interesting. And this new the Haitian government is headed by Gerard Latortu, a legitimacy it has not earned and does not deserve. Indeed, 33 of the 39 members of the Congressional Black Caucus stayed away from a recent Washington meeting arranged by two congressmen for Latortu. So this is one of them, another one of them little, you know, puppets they got to go do their bidding in Haiti. The United States demand that CARICOM abandon its long-held insistence on democratic principles is psychic poison to the region. When Eastern Europe was going through its totalitarian nightmare, when coups and despotic rule were normal in Central and South America, and when civil strife and dictatorship racked much of Africa and Asia, the Caribbean steadfastly upheld its democratic traditions. And it continues to do so today. And Sam don't like it. Well,
That's going to be all right now for the Making It Plain News. Please, come on back and check us next week. And remember that this program is in the public domain. We want you to listen to it, to share it with your friends, and pass it.
Well, that's just going to about wrap it up for Slade tonight. Now, it's clear that Condoleezza Rice has her side when you hear how she is willing to put the lives of one G.I. Joe above those black people throughout the Caribbean. There is nothing to say to someone like that. And there's really nothing you could say to her that is going to make her look the other way. Unless you say, duck, here it comes. That's the type of reality that we need to release ourselves to and from. Until the next time, slave revolt. Out.